This is WGRE 91.5 FM, Greencastle, Indiana.
Good evening, and welcome to Music for Life, Music from DePaul. This week, we speak to our violin professor, Dan Risner, about his annual performances with the Grand Teton Music Festival. We have our five-minute iPod and Question You Never Asked segments. We review the amazing performance of the American String Quartet here at DePaul. We talk with piano professor Mei Pong about our upcoming piano competition. Plus, we have thrilling news about a dramatic transformation of Thompson Recital Hall. There are lots of exciting things happening in the School of Music this week, and we're glad you could join us for Music for Life. I'm here with our professor of violin, Dan Risner. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here.
It's great to be here.
Professor Risner has been our violin professor for quite a while, since 1982. One of our senior faculty members at DePaul. And we're also chatting about what our professors do, not just in the School of Music, but outside the School of Music. And actually, Professor Risner has been with the Grand Teton Music Festival. I think you're also one of the early people in that, right?
Yeah, one of the early people. My first summer was 1976. I was just out of my undergraduate from Michigan State, and I found out about the festival from Elsa Verdere, who was the wife of Walter Verdere, my violin teacher, and she encouraged me to send a tape to Ling Tung, who
was the conductor. So you auditioned as an undergraduate?
Just after my undergraduate.
Wow. Congratulations. That's, that had to be quite an accomplishment to get in as just having completed your undergraduate degree and get
into the... Well, I was just thrilled for the opportunity to perform in this orchestra, and I'd heard so much about it from Elsa. And so my first summer there was actually the first summer following my undergraduate years. So my wife and I had just gotten married, so it was our honeymoon there, which was wonderful. And then I've been going back ever since. Missed a few summers between 1976 and 2011, but last summer was my 31st summer, and it was actually the 50th anniversary of the festival.
Wow. So for folks who aren't familiar with this festival, tell us about it.
Okay, well, this festival started in Jackson Hole, Wyoming in 1961, and it started actually in the high school gymnasium, Jackson, by some art patrons there. And then when Ling Tung took over and his wife Margot, they moved the festival to Teton Village and set up a tent. So the first concerts were in an outdoor tent. And then in 1974, they built Walk Festival Hall, named after Margot Walk and the Walk family that gave the money for it. And they secured the land from the Jackson Hole Ski Corporation. So just recently, the hall went under a renovation, and it's just a wonderful performing space, an amphitheater-style performing hall.
And so many folks go to this. I mean, it's amazing the number of people over the years
right.
that have had this experience.
Right.
But how many people do you see in a single summer?
In a single summer, well, I'm there typically for 3 weeks. So the orchestra at that time, when I'm there for the first 3 weeks, is typically full-size orchestra. Last summer, the most memorable performance for me was the Mahler Second Symphony the second week. So that takes 10 horns and
huge orchestra.
Yeah, huge orchestra.
Yeah,
yeah.
And how many people will see the?
It seats, I believe, about 900.
And then how many weeks do you play? Do the performances last how many weeks?
7 weeks. But during that 7 weeks, there are about 300 musicians that move in and out.
Wow.
And most are symphony players. So you would think that during their vacation time, they wouldn't want to
play
orchestra music,
right.
But it's a different environment for them.
Right.
And they just love the environment, not only the mountains, but just the camaraderie from playing with friends over the years.
Yeah, Jackson Hole is one of the most beautiful places in the world.
So
just to go there would be great, but to hear great music like this is a real bonus.
It is. It's great to be there, and the flexible schedule, they give you a little bit of time here and there to do things. So out of that 300, there are about 25 of us
wow.
that teach at universities.
And you've got to be one of the senior, because you've been there for so many years. How many people have been there longer than you in the orchestra?
Well, I think maybe a half a dozen have. The longest attending member, Marcia Peck from the Minnesota Orchestra, has been there 41 seasons out of the 50 last summer.
Oh, my.
So,
and you had done 31 of the
31, 50. Yeah.
Wow.
So,
and you've seen a lot of conductors come and go. Now you've got Donald Runicles there.
Yes, we do. And he's doing a wonderful job. Really enjoy working with him. Very respectful of all the musicians. Before that, 6 years before 2006, Eiji Owe, mm-hmm. who had the Minnesota Orchestra conducted. And then before that, it was Ling Tung, who had the orchestra for mm-hmm. over 20 years.
Is this Runicle's first year?
It was his sixth year.
So he's been there a while.
So he's been there a while. But some of the more memorable performances, I was thinking back on this, would have been 2001 when Eiji Owe conducted. He was at the Minnesota Orchestra at that time, but he came and conducted a concert we did of the first half was the Rite of Spring, and the second half was the Alpine Symphony of Strauss.
That is a tough
and
program.
It was tough, and at that time, we didn't know if we were playing first or second violin, so I learned the first violin part just in case, and it's a good thing I did because I was playing first, and I had to be ready to go with it, and it was memorable because there are such great pieces of symphonic orchestra music, but also the fact that Eiji conducted from memory.
Both works. Oh, my God.
And flawlessly.
Yeah, these are two of the most challenging pieces in the repertoire.
Yeah.
I actually saw that very pairing just before from Baltimore. The BSO put those two pieces mm-hmm. together, too. And, you know, I remember seeing it in the program and thinking, oh, you're kidding. Can, you know, that's way to kill an orchestra because that's a challenging program and that never lets up. And to be able to hear it there at Jackson mm-hmm. Hole has got to be remarkable. Mm-hmm. And then Runicle is a great conductor and known for a lot of reasons, mm-hmm. but I think two things that people know about him right off the top is one, that he conducts with a stick in the other hand, which is kind of unusual.
That's unusual to be left-handed.
It takes a little getting used to, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Because most left-handed conductors keep the stick in their right hand because their better hand then is doing the more graceful, challenging work in some ways.
I didn't know.
So that's got to be a little interesting for you guys, though, to get used to looking the other place for the beat point.
It is, but he's very clear in his conducting pattern. But also, what's different about having Donald conduct the orchestra is the fact that he put the second violins on the outside.
Right.
Where the cellos used to be for many years with Ling Tung and the violas next to the cellos and then seconds and first. But he has the second violins on the outside, and it's sometimes very hard to hear the first violins, and right next to you are the violas, and the cellos are next to the first violin, and the bass is behind the cellos.
Right, yeah, and that's an unusual, although it's coming back into vogue, mm-hmm. it used to be that way, probably more. From the audience's perspective, it's really exciting because it gives us the stereophonic effect between the violinists.
Mm-hmm.
As a conductor, I never did that because of the challenges that you mentioned. The violins are separate, and now they've got to listen across the ensemble to catch each other. That's a whole new set of challenges.
And you couldn't do it with some conductors that didn't have a clear beat pattern. You wouldn't be together. But Donald's very clear, and the recordings come out wonderfully because you hear the second violins in a way that you've never heard before.
Right. And he's such a great conductor. And musicians tend to really love him. Is that a fair statement?
I would say that's absolutely true. There is mutual respect there. Mm-hmm. You know, he isn't just respecting the stars of the orchestra, you know, the principal flute and principal oboe, but he values every musician who comes there.
You know, and this is part of what makes the DePauw experience unique and wonderful is that our faculty are not just great teachers, but they're great performers in their own right, and they're out doing it in really wonderful places. And we're fortunate that we have you here, and we have you representing
us
there.
Thank you so much. I am so fortunate to have the opportunity to play there every summer and be invited back. It's just something that's really developed me as a musician, but also enhanced my teaching. I'm so happy to work on orchestral excerpts with my students. This is an important part of their violin training that is often neglected in favor of the traditional old school
solo works. Right, exactly.
And their opportunities to perform after graduation are going to be in a symphony orchestra.
Exactly. It's so important to their own training and that you're regularly practicing your own work. You know, you're practicing what you preach on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Informs our students so much. We're glad you were able to join us today and
thank you
chat
so
with
much.
Us about it.
Thank you so much, Mark. Thank you.
Hi, I'm John Pierce Kraft, and I'm giving my senior recital on April 14th at 7:30 p.m. in Thompson Recital Hall. Hope to see you there.
Hi, I'm Josiah Rushing, and I'm giving my junior recital on April 13th at 7:30 in Thompson Recital Hall. Hope to see you there.
For those of you new to Music for Life, the 5-minute iPod segment is about what would you do if you were stranded on a desert island and you only had an iPod that would play for 5 minutes or so. Joining me for this week's 5-minute iPod section is Veronica Bedrill. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
So explain to us your rather unique position in the School of Music.
I have a dual role as both staff and faculty. I work as an instructional technologist helping folks of faculty role all over the campus with their audio needs and their music technology needs. And I also teach courses in digital musicianship for the School of Music.
So something tells me that's going to have an impact on your choice for your 5-minute iPod piece.
Absolutely. The piece that I've chosen today is by Paul Lansky, who was my graduate thesis advisor. And he wrote this piece titled Tables Clear back in 1990, when actually we were together. And he wrote it on a Next computer, which was
the precursor to the new operating system for the Mac.
It was Steve Jobs' foray outside of Apple.
Tell me about the piece.
Well, the piece relies exclusively on sounds that Paul recorded of his children in his kitchen. It's off an album entitled Homebrew, and all of the pieces on that album rely upon found sounds from around the world around him.
Mm-hmm. And I should tell all of our listeners that this is one you'll want to hear in stereo. So if you can put on your headphones or make sure you've got good stereo separation for what we're about to hear, tell us how it opens.
Well, it opens up with a rather random cacophony of the kitchen sounds beating on pots and pans, as we all are wont to do while we are children. But then those sounds begin organizing and sort of forming small clouds of rhythm and turning later in the piece into sort of a gamelan kind of instrument.
Ah, so because our iPod is broken and can only play 5 minutes, we're going to show you just a little segment of the beginning. But then we're going to jump ahead to your favorite part.
Sounds good to me.
So tell us about your favorite part.
Well, the favorite part is kind of a breakdown section where the rhythm challenges itself. And again, we start hearing elements of the children and their voices. And they add some new timbral qualities, which he then brings into the mix at about 8 minutes into the piece. So it's a real fascinating way that he incorporates that. I think one of the reasons that I want this on a desert island is because this piece in particular reminds me that even if I have no musical instruments around me, that even on a desert island, I can find a way to make music with the things that are around me.
So we'll look forward to your Coconut Symphony on Absolutely. Our next 5-minute iPod.
Oh, Dad.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Alex Metzel, and I'm giving my junior recital on April 14th in Thompson Recital Hall. Hope to see you there.
Hi, I'm Mikey Padilla, and I'm giving my senior recital on May 5th at 5 in Thompson Recital Hall. I'll see you there.
We were on hiatus for 2 weeks because of spring break here at DePaul, but a few weeks ago we had the amazing American String Quartet performing, and we have joining us to chat about that one of our own students, Carl Wirt, cellist. Welcome.
Hi.
And earlier in the day we were speaking with our violin professor, Dan Risner, so I asked him if he'd hang on for us to chat a bit about that, so thanks for hanging on.
Certainly. Thanks for having me.
What an amazing performance. You guys as knocked out by that as I was.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. It was amazing.
There were so many great moments, it's hard to isolate any one thing that made that so terrific. What was your take, Carl?
I was just amazed by the bow control and the Haydn. I thought their bow movement really defied gravity almost.
Yeah, this is a group that does the basics so well that they're all textbook examples of how to play.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What did you think, Professor Risner?
Well, I mean, their interpretations were wonderful. They're obviously very comfortable with each other after many years of playing. The cellist is newest to the group, but he played beautifully and provided such a wonderful bass line all the time. The Schubert Death and the Maiden was especially memorable, I think. It was just so elegantly played with incredible energy. And as you said, their basics are so secure, their intonation is flawless. Their ensemble is just as flawless.
Yeah, there's times where their lines are handed between instruments and you can't figure out when it changed. Yeah. You know, when it went from viola to cello or from violin to, you know, it's like, wow, when did that? Because it's just so impeccable.
Yeah, and it's so wonderful to bring them and have them work with our students in a masterclass situation as well. Carl was in the masterclass playing the Beethoven Ghost Trio. And I'm sure you enjoyed having them coach you.
Yeah, definitely. It was, you know, it was kind of a little intimidating having all four of them throw comments at us at once, but sometimes different comments.
Yeah, what a great opportunity to have a string quartet of that stature and of that accomplishment come in and work with an undergraduate group.
That's right.
You know, because oftentimes these folks go to a university setting, they're going to work with the grad students, you know.
That's right.
And here, the undergraduates get this opportunity to kind of be thrown into the deep end of the pool to work with talent like that.
But they were very helpful, very cordial, and they're just really nice people. Not only great musicians, but very nice people as well.
Yeah, and that's such a wonderful thing when that happens, because oftentimes you get these great talents And they're not really easy people to work with, right. And they're not really interested in reaching down to the next generation and paying forward. These guys were just fantastic.
They seem to really enjoy working with all of you.
And you had the opportunity to interview that cellist.
Yeah, his name is Wolfram Kossel, yeah, cello.
And so how'd that happen?
Well, I kind of contacted him through the members, and I told him about a class that I was taking, music entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. and my project, which was to interview several quartets and their members, and compile kind of a portfolio of all of what I've learned about starting a new quartet or getting into the chamber music scene, those kind of questions.
So what kinds of things did you chat about?
He first kind of told me of his life story of how, you know, he grew up in Germany and he really grew up around chamber music. Like that's what they do there is mm-hmm. they play all the time as kids, and he moved to New York, and really I was surprised that he did an extensive amount of freelance work.
In a quartet?
In a quartet, yes.
And, you know, or in quartets, I should say. In chamber music or freelance work as a soloist or what type of
You know,
of
really
work?
Both. Uh-huh. He participated in the Mark Morris dance group.
Really? He played with Mark Morris?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a great opportunity. Yeah. That's remarkable.
I mean, Yo-Yo played in that group.
And, yeah.
Yeah. So right. That was great. I kind of also talked about like how you network yourself in a freelance world. And he said it's really all about playing and performing just as much as you can, just, you know, taking every opportunity that you can.
So what was the greatest thing you learned from your time with him in that conversation?
I think if you want to go into chamber music, you always have to stay in that world. Mm-hmm. Kind of. You can't take an orchestra job, because he said that if you do something like that, other people won't, you know, respect you as a chamber musician, mm-hmm. which was really kind of shocking, because, you know, I thought I could always do chamber music outside of an orchestra job or something like that.
Yeah, you know, it's really funny, because I think that Music for Life, the radio show, kind of has a life of its own, and for those who've listened to it for many episodes, you'll have heard this very conversation go on. It's funny how this theme comes back, because playing in a chamber ensemble is radically different from the orchestral experience. And it's interesting to take one of the great chamber players here who steps out and says, not only is it radically different, don't do the other thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the skills that you acquire as a chamber musician are so radically different from mm-hmm. those necessary to be a great orchestral musician. And there might be a challenge getting people to understand those differences.
Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. You know, this is also one of the exciting things about being at an undergraduate institution that focuses on your performance to the extent that we do and brings in artists like this. Because here's an opportunity for you as an undergraduate. What year is this for you?
I'm a senior this
year. So your senior year, yeah. you've had 4 years of experience playing chamber music as an undergraduate, and you get the opportunity to sit one-on-one with a cellist in the American String Quartet and talk about your career.
Yeah, that was a really great experience.
And I admire your forward thinking to contact them and to take the initiative. You know, it seems to be a DePauw trait. You guys are really good at taking the initiative and being very straightforward and proactive in making the most of your careers.
Well, yeah, I hope so.
And, you know, we talk about the Schubert, you know, and Schubert is kind of unfairly, I think, pigeonholed as a tunesmith. You know, it's because his melodies are so perfect that you just love him melodically.
Yeah.
But then you get something as profound as Death of the Maiden.
Yeah.
Death of the Maiden is just fantastic.
It's just, yeah, amazing how he wrote such a simple theme and what he could do with that and the theme of variations. It's so dynamic to write such incredible variations on such a simple.
Yeah. And just one profound variation after another on such little material to deal with. You know, it's really not that much there.
Thank you.
What was your take on the whole concert? Was there a particular high moment for you, Carl?
Yeah, like kind of like I said, the Haydn, really. I was surprised about how well their performance was and really how that brought my understanding of the work to a really new level for me as an audience member, which was incredible.
So true, and it's funny, Haydn, the father of the string quartet, you know, considered the beginning of it. If string quartets had stopped with Haydn, we'd still be okay. You know, people came after and did wonderful things, and we're glad they did. But the truth is, there's so much to Haydn.
Yeah, there is. Those are great. Yeah. Those are great quartets. And actually, one of our string quartets here at DePauw performed that last semester. It's a very good piece for working on ensemble. Right. It was great for them to hear it performed by such a high-caliber string quartet.
This is one of the things I love about being at DePauw, is that I'm sitting here across the table from student and faculty together talking about a remarkable opportunity that enhanced all of our lives.
Absolutely.
Of being able to hear the American String Quartet. So thanks for stopping by to chat about it.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lauren Palmer, and I'm giving my senior recital on April 14th at 3 p.m. in Thompson Recital Hall. Hope to see you there.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Farmer, and I'm giving my senior recital on April 29th at 7:30 p.m. in Thompson Recital Hall. Hope to see you there.
Joining me this week for the question you never asked is Music for Life staff member Adam Lumen. Welcome back, Adam.
Nice to be here.
What's the question this week?
What does the conductor do?
Great. We're still trying to figure that out. No one's gotten the answer to that yet. I say that as a conductor myself. But what does the conductor do? So they're just waving their arms so the music stops, then they turn around and bow, right? That's what it's all about?
Just about, actually. The waving arms itself is actually probably the smallest part of a conductor's job. Because by the time of the performance, hopefully, if they have done their job, the orchestra or the choir, you know, they know the pieces. They're not going to get lost. They don't need to really see where the beats are. The biggest part, I would say, in a conductor's job is actually the rehearsals beforehand.
Right. I think that people are mystified by what the conductor does because they're up there making all of these gestures, and I think people mistakenly think that it's all about just timekeeping. But the truth is there's a whole series of stuff that happens, and when you're seeing the concert, you're seeing the tip of a very large iceberg, right?
Exactly.
And so the process backs up far before that. Now, you know this. You've had Conducting 1, and you're now in Conducting 2, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, so as a student of conducting, what kinds of things are you studying?
A lot of what we're working on is actually that gesture, but not just to be able to do it in the performance, but to be able to do it in practice so you have more efficient rehearsals.
Right, the more you can say with your hands and your face and your body, the less you have to say with your words, and that's time is money.
Yep.
You know, people don't think this, but when you're rehearsing a professional ensemble, every minute might be thousands of dollars. If you have to stop and explain something, you just cost us $1,000. But if you can demonstrate it with your hands and with your body, then we don't need to hear you talk, and you've saved us that money.
Time is a valuable thing in the professional world. Mm-hmm. With some professional choirs, like the choir for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, they get 6 rehearsals on a work with a conductor, and then they're set to go, and they have to perform.
It is amazing how quickly these things get put together. And especially if you've ever played when you were in high school or whatever, you're used to rehearsing for weeks on end and then the concert at the end of the year. But it's not that way. One every week, here it comes. And the conductor really has to know their stuff.
They really do.
So part of it is stick technique or hand technique. Part of it is that physical gesture. What's the rest of it?
A lot of it is being the ears for the ensemble. If you're in an orchestra, you have the music in front of you that's only your part. In the choir, you have the music with all the parts, but you're still only looking at yours.
Right, right.
You know, you need somebody out there who can actually hear what it all sounds like.
Right, there's only one set of ears, as far as the performers are concerned. There's only one set of ears in front of the ensemble. That's the conductors. Everybody else's understanding of the music they're hearing is kind of corrupted by where they stand. Because if you're standing in the middle of the alto section, you know, you're hearing a lot of alto.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to trust that the conductor standing in front of you is saying, you have to back down, because out here where it matters, where it's too much alto, or we need a little more flute here, or whatever, that's part of what they're doing. So you're being the ears, and you're adjusting it on the fly. That's true.
Mm-hmm. And then a lot of stylistic decisions, those are going to be made by the conductor. You know, what type of articulation, if they're doing that enough, and how that comes across to the audience is going to be decided by them.
Right. Leonard Bernstein said the conductor's paid to win the arguments. You know, he's having a discussion with the concertmaster. The concertmaster says this has to be short, and he says no, it has to be long. And he goes, well, here's why it has to be short. And Bernstein responds and says, no, here's why it has to be long. And the conversation goes on and on. And then he says, well, it's going to be long. And he says, well, why? And he goes, because the conductor is paid to win the arguments. And I think that's true. The conductor is the ultimate voice that decides how this work will be performed. So that's very important. One really important thing as a part of that is that the amount of time spent in score study and preparing this music. As a conducting teacher, I always told my students the little joke about the boy who sees the sculptor in the garden in the park, and he's carving out a man and a horse, but only the front half of it is done. But it's really amazing because the back of it's just this big rock, and here's this clearly coming out man and a horse. And the little boy comes up to the sculptor and says, that's miraculous. How do you do that? And he says, well, it's really easy. I take this hammer and chisel, I knock away anything that doesn't look like a man or a horse. And that's really what conductors do. You have in your head, before the first rehearsal, the man and the horse. You know exactly how this music is to sound. Now, what you get is a big block of stuff, and you have to chip away everything that doesn't sound like what you have in your mind. So, as a listener, what am I supposed to do when I come to a concert? Am I supposed to just watch the conductor? Which, of course, he has his back to me, or she has her back to me, so I can't even really get much out of that. What's that about?
The most important thing when you're at a concert is listening to the music, because that's what all the effort is into creating. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can watch the conductor. Some can be very interesting to watch, like Urbanski with the ISO last week. Mm-hmm. There's others that are much more simple, like if you've ever gone to a middle school choir concert.
Right.
But the real reason that everyone's there is to listen to the music.
And that's what's most important. And so the conductor is actually reading everyone's music, or in the case of Urbanski, has it all memorized, but they're dealing with the music. They're making on-the-fly decisions about how this music's not quite what they had in mind and how they need to blend and balance this thing or that. And it is their interpretation of the music that is being heard. Mm-hmm. And the rest of it is all in the effort to get that done. Little demystification of what conductors do. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, I'm Eric Christopher Craig, and I'm giving my senior recital on Thursday, April 12th at 7:30 in Thompson Recital Hall. Hope to see you there.
Hi, my name's Claire Jagla, and I sing soprano. I'm giving my senior recital on May 5th at 3 p.m. in Thompson Recital Hall. I promise a choo-choo train and a showdown between a cowboy and Indian. I hope to see you there.
We are blessed at DePauw to have a fantastic piano faculty, and we've chatted with several members of our faculty on the show, but joining me today is one of our really stellar pianists, May Pong. Welcome.
Good morning.
I am such a big fan of your playing. I have enjoyed your performances so much from the very first time I heard you play, and any chance that you have to hear May perform anywhere, you need to take advantage of it, because she is a true artist and a remarkable pianist. You've been at DePauw for about
9 years.
Nine years.
Yes.
You started your study in Singapore, correct?
Yes. My musical study really began in the States.
Oh, did it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And you came from Singapore to?
To Philadelphia. At that time, there was no formal musical training in Singapore, and people there encouraged me to go abroad study. That's how I landed up in North America.
Well, it was our good fortune that that happened. So, in addition to your performing and teaching here, you also run a piano competition, correct?
Yes, I do.
And so tell me a little bit about that.
This was a venture I began in 2004. That was our first edition. I thought there are so many competitions out there nowadays. Young people here are used to performing at the solo ensembles every mm-hmm. spring. I wanted a competition that was a little more serious, but something that was a transition between the very high caliber competitions for the young ones mm-hmm. and something that was a little bit more challenging than solo ensemble
right.
contest,
right.
for example. The first 2 years, we were fortunate enough to have a composer actually on our faculty, Carlos uh-huh. Carrillo. Uh-huh. And he very kindly wrote and provided a special composition for these young contestants.
Wow.
So there was a 21st century component that was the required piece.
Wow.
That was my intention to make this competition a little bit special.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes.
And so it's been in, how many years have we done this?
This year would be, I believe, the eighth.
The eighth year. And it's coming up right around the corner, correct?
Yes.
And is it one-day event?
Yes, it is.
And so how do you feel about the contestants over the past? Have they been unique and fantastic, or what have you found now that we've heard it for many years?
Over the board, it's been very surprising. We get a lot of very high caliber pianists. Oh. And they are so young, and they play like professionals.
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing. And I get a lot of calls from parents or teachers who are new or maybe starting and sending their students and children out to compete. And they ask, well, what's the caliber of the general field? And I say, I do not know, because it varies from year to year.
Right.
And sometimes a ninth grader might do so much better than a 12th grader.
Yeah.
There's no way of telling.
Right. It is amazing, the talent that's out there today. And the winners of this get a cash award and a scholarship to DePauw if they choose to come here. It's an opportunity for us to fill a niche that we feel is important and has been incredibly successful for us here at DePauw. And we're very fortunate that you brought it to us.
Yes, thank you. And one thing I would like to maybe encourage the public to do is to come listen to them. And also for the contestants, I think it's a very good opportunity for them to listen to their peers.
Right. The competition is open to the public. This
is
important.
Open to the public.
Yes. And it's coming up
April 15th.
April 15th, tax day. So what better way to spend tax day, get your mind off your taxes, and come out and hear the next generation of great pianists here.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
So before I let May out of the studio, I want to say how blown away I was by a performance that she did last semester, it was, of a piece called Turning. Remember that piece?
I'm sure you do. Yes, I really do.
I understand you didn't have much time to put that together.
No, I didn't. There is so much piano repertoire out there that I am always tempted to do this, do that. And the thing is, it's very interesting how many different ways a program can come together.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought I had gotten my program together already. And then I encountered this piece a couple of weeks before. And, well, I really have to do it if I was going to do the Bach, because it seems to fit. Well, that's in my own mind,
mm-hmm.
of course.
Right. So I hear this concert. I'm new. I'm the new dean. I come in. I sit down to hear this recital. And I am blown away by this performance, and I'm thinking, boy, she knows this piece so well, and she plays it by memory. This is obviously out of her standard repertoire. And I find out the next day, you just learned it the week before.
I was really just wondering, why are you saying what you're saying?
Right. I was just absolutely, it was not only amazing because how well it was played, but it was amazing how little time you had to prepare it. So this is a little clip of one of our piano professors, May Pong, doing a remarkable performance called Turning.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up our show this week, and we're glad you could join us at Music for Life, Music from DePauw. Our student producers are Sam Crocker, Adam Luman, Anna Gadula, and Phil Pasqua. Our show is produced and engineered by Matthew Champagne and recorded live in Studio B of the Green Center for the Performing Arts. I'm Mark McCoy. I'm the executive producer of Music for Life and dean of the School of Music. And we're glad you could join us once again. And we hope that you'll join us next Sunday night at 6 p.m. on WGRE for Music for Life. You can also catch us on the podcast, available at iTunes. And you can email us at musicforlife@depauw.edu. This has been an exciting week in the School of Music as we rededicated a renovated Thompson Recital Hall. Thompson went through a much-needed and remarkable renovation this week with the kind gift of Vera Mae Farber, class of 36, graduated from the School of Music, and she was here to celebrate her 99th birthday and the grand reopening of Thompson Recital Hall. This remarkable School of Music graduate had an incredible career as a teacher and performer and author, and decided that she wanted to see Thompson Recital Hall in a new light. So this week we opened the hall, we brought her together to celebrate her 99th birthday. We had 200 musicians sing happy birthday to her, and we had a great morning recital. This is from that recital. This is Carl Wirt on cello, who we heard from earlier in the show, Zach Phillips on violin, and Lizzie Wynn on piano on a bit of the Beethoven Ghost Trio.
It's Music for Life.